White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the International Jew Study Hour with Carolyn Yeager and Hadding Scott.
Hello.
And it is October 25th, and this is episode 18. You know, Hadding and listeners, this week we begin chapter 15, which is a pretty long chapter that we probably could not finish. I'm sure we could not finish it in one session. So I thought it would be a good idea to begin tonight's episode with a continuation of our discussion of the authenticity question concerning the origins of the protocols that we talked about in last week's episode, and some listeners had comments about it, and plus one wanted to hear more from your side, Hadding. So since we are coming, he thought I was probably, as I've been accused of many times, interrupting you before you finished what you were going to say.
Well, you did, but I said essentially what I wanted.
Yeah, I know. I know if you wanted to say more, you would have. So I knew that that was a so, but I still do. I don't wait for you to finish because I think you're finished. So I know, very bad. I'm better than, I don't know if I am, but it's something that I tend to do. Some listeners are bothered by it. So since we are coming to the end of the chapters dealing with the protocols, and it occurs to me that it's, in fact, this one doesn't even talk about them quite as much as the previous ones did, doesn't quote from them so much and so on, I figure it's now or never that we continue dealing with this topic, which I now have gotten kind of interested in since I have started looking at it. And I did some more study of the Peter Myers material and also what is on some of the Wikipedia pages. And I now have a definite changed position from the one I took when we began this International Jew Study Hour program, which is that when we began, my position was just, well, I had no position on whether they were, you know, authentic or, you know, what they were written for or who wrote them or whatever, only that I thought that what they expressed was very valuable stuff for us to know, and it appeared to be so accurate in so many areas that it was valuable and we should study it. But I had no, I said, well, I wouldn't say, you know, anything more about it because I don't know. Well, now I think I can say something more about it. And I have shifted over toward saying they could, they're authentic, but they're not necessarily the minutes. They weren't necessarily read at that first Zionist Congress. They weren't necessarily put in the minutes there because, the fact.
Well, you're saying that it's authentic, but it's not authentic, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is that the very sources and reasons that are given for it not being authentic can also be used to argue that it is authentic, but not the part about necessarily being the minutes of that in the minutes of that meeting. I don't know where that came from.
That's the whole question right there. If it's not the minutes of a meeting where the Jews plan these things,
well, it goes way back.
What?
Oh, it goes way back. The whole thing is what I'm going to present here.
You might be able to show sources from which ideas in it were derived, but that doesn't. What does that prove? Everybody derives their ideas from somewhere.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. None of this is new. I mean, it doesn't have to be something newly written for this first Zionist Congress in order to be the authentic.
Something written for this alleged Zionist Congress. It's supposed to be the minutes, record of what was said at this alleged meeting in 1896. If it isn't that, then it's not authoritative.
Okay, let's look at
that. That's the whole
thing.
If you claim that it's a record of what the Jews agreed they were going to do in 1896 or what they agreed that they were in process of doing, then it carries an authority that otherwise it just doesn't have.
Oh, well, no, wait, let's look at the authority.
It's just somebody's observations.
No. Let's look at the authority on this. Because this is the argument that the Jews put forth. This is what they put forth, and we're supposed to believe it.
Nobody lies 100% of the time. Come on.
Okay. All right. Well, now let's just start out. Let me go through this. It might take the first half hour of this program, but in Wikipedia, I read the Protocols is one of the best known and most discussed examples of literary forgery and analysis, and proof of its fraudulent origin goes back as far as 1921. I thought, whoa, is that all, 1921? Well, yeah, in 1921, Philip Graves brought this plagiarism to light, they say, in a series of articles.
Graves was not
Times.
A Jew.
Right. In 1921, he's the Times of London, I take it, the first published evidence that the Protocols was not an authentic document. And, you know, now right here, it occurs to me that the word should be original, that it is not an original document. But it is not, that doesn't mean it's not authentic. I mean, here, the word authentic is kind of strange, you know? It can be used, to denounce something that is not fact, doesn't mean that it's not true. It's just not what somebody has claimed it to be. Now,
but that's what the word authentic means. The word authentic is from Greek, autentikos. It means it's that very thing. That's what authentic means. It means it's that very thing. It means it's genuine.
Yeah,
it's what it's claimed
genuine?
To be.
Yeah,
it's
genuine.
It's not what it's claimed to be. It's not the minutes of a meeting.
It's not original. It's not originally prepared for this in 1897 for this. Well, it's only in this one book that it's called that it says that it was for the. I mean, that is presented as being prepared for this Zionist Congress, but they are much older than that, you know? All the ideas in the Protocols are much older than that. So that means
yeah,
that
sure. A lot of them come from Plato, as a matter of fact. The idea that a liberal system gives way to an autocracy, that comes from Plato, Eighth Book of the Republic.
Well, you can't have it always. You can't say that. Well, because portions were taken from Maurice Joly, that proves that it's a forgery.
It proves
and then
it's
say,
not
well,
minutes
it
of a
goes
meeting.
Back to Plato and it does this and it does that. Now, you know, if some ideas go back to Plato, then they can't have come from Maurice Joly, all right? Or they don't have to have some particular kind of source in order to be authentic. So let's see how far back we can go with this. Now, just as far as the precursors, okay? Because I'm going to go back, but not right away, to usury, to the Jewish use of usury, then to Freemasonry, then to a revolution like the French Revolution, and then to the world government. So that's the steps that have been taken. And the very earliest I can go back in a definite line in this subject matter of Machiavelli and so on is De Mazares in his book, it's in French, De Machiavel and the Influence of His Doctrine on some French politics and so on. It's published in 1816. And wording is kind of weird, but I got it down here now that it's having been inaugurated by the French Revolution, which was at the end of the 18th century, and about what was carried on by Napoleon I, against whom he brings precisely the same accusations of Machiavellism that Joly brings against Napoleon III. So it was similar to what Joly wrote about Napoleon III, but this guy was writing it about Napoleon I. That's what it is. 1816 it was published. And then a precursor to Jolie that everybody seems to agree with is this Eugene Sue, S-U-E, friend, another Frenchman, who was strongly affected by the
Soviet Union. I think he was a Jew, actually. He wrote a book called The Wandering Jew, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he did, but does that make him a Jew? And he might be a Jew. I don't care if he's a Jew or not. It didn't say in there that he was a Jew. So you believe, you need to check that out. He was, I don't think he was a Jew. No. He was, although he did get well known, was Alexander Dumas a Jew?
He's a mulatto.
Alexander Dumas Père was a mulatto?
Yes, he was.
Really? A strong mulatto?
Well, look at a picture of him. He had woolly hair.
Oh, well, he had woolly hair.
He was a mulatto. He was.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, Eugene Sue was a contemporary, say, of Alexander Dumas Père. And he was quite well known, very popular, was compared to Dumas, in ability, although he doesn't, later on they don't quite think he matches up, but he has he had socialist ideas of the day, and he wrote some anti-Catholic novels, Mystery of Paris and Journal of the Wandering Jew, and then these were his most popular works, and they were serial novels. 1842, 1843, then the next one, 1844 and 45. So that's when he was writing. Then a little bit later, 1849 to 1856, he produced a very big volume called The Mysteries of the People, I think it is, Les Mysteries du Peuple. And it was suppressed by the censor in 1857 after it came out. I don't know anything more about that. But this is the one that this Mysteries of the People by Eugene Sue, 1849-1856, was plagiarized by Maurice Joly in his Dialogue in Hell, which came out in 1864, only a few years later. So it wasn't that he went back in history to find something to take it from. It was that it was current, and he used some of the same ideas. So these people had a lot of the same ideas, and these were probably just not considered plagiarism, but just, I don't know. They want to call it now plagiarized, but how could you hide that? But anyway, it was Jolie's book is considered a political satire. And then, of course, supposedly the protocols were plagiarized from Jolie. Now, so Jolie copied, parts of it. So Jolie copied from Eugene Sue. And there's another guy, Goethe, or I don't know, how do you pronounce it? G-O-E-D-S-C-H-E.
Goethe.
Hermann Goethe, a Prussian. He started a career in something, didn't work out, so he turned to writing, and he wrote literary fiction under the pen name Sir John Ratcliffe. In 1968, came out with the novel Biarritz, B-I-A-R-R-I-T-Z, and it contained a chapter. We're talking only about one chapter in this novel called The Jewish Cemetery in Prague and the Council of Representatives of the 12 Tribes of Israel. In it, He depicted a clandestine nocturnal meeting of members of a mysterious rabbinical cabal that is planning a diabolical Jewish conspiracy. At midnight, the devil appears to contribute his opinions and insight. The chapter closely resembles a scene in Alexander Dumas Pair's The Queen's Necklace. So again, this chapter is similar to a chapter in Alexander Dumas, I guess it's a novel, The Queen's Necklace, but it's that came out in 1848, and Goethe's came out in 1868, 20 years later. So, it's like people were taking things from other people. So Goethe copied Dumas, he also may have taken some of his ideas from Joly, because Joly's pamphlet appeared 4 years before Biarritz by Goethe, and may well have been the inspiration for his fictional Midnight Meeting. and details of the outcome of the supposed plot. So Gertsch's chapter may have been an outright plagiarism of Jolie or of Dumas Père or both. So this is what was going on at the time. Lots of this type of Jewish conspiracy thinking and writing. And although with Jolie, it supposedly was not Jews, right? It was whoever was
Napoleon III.
Yeah, and Machiavellianism and so on. Now, in 1860, in the midst of all this, the Alliance Israelite Universelle had arisen, having for its ultimate object the great work of humanity, the annihilation of error and fanaticism, the union of human society in a faithful and solid fraternity, a formula singularly reminiscent of Grand Orient philosophy. Grand Orient, of course, being one of the major Freemason orders. So we've got, I've got a timeline here, but I don't know if I'm going to bother with that because I already kind of went through it. So from here, I want to just go back to when usury started. And it's some interesting information that paper money was first used in China. And by about the 13th century, it made its debut in Europe. However, it was crucially different in its form, function, and implications from China's paper money. It was issued not by the government, as they did in China, but by a private group of businessmen, which this was the biggest trick in history. They charged interest for issuing paper slips that cost them nothing to produce, these businessmen. They became wealthier and henceforth would be known as bankers. The bankers had managed to do what kings, emperors, and alchemists had failed to do. They were creating money. They had found the philosopher's stone. Well, you know, because they were trying to create gold, right? I used to read about that. They were trying to create gold from different things because that was the source of money at the time. They couldn't do that, but now he's saying that, you know, that these bankers discovered how to do that with paper money and creating what was the central bank of their time. They had this had fundamental implications that were to change the course of history. Okay, that's important. Change the course of history, for it meant that the allocation of new purchasing power was not under the control of the government. And Europe's monarchs did not see through the deception. They naively believed that the bankers had large amounts of gold, which they didn't have. When governments needed money and could not raise taxes further, they too thought they had to borrow from the bankers. You know, what was wrong? These people couldn't seem to get the idea that they could do it. Yeah, it was that the bankers were just doing what the kings could have done themselves, as we know today, that our governments can do what the bankers are doing. But we let the bankers do it, which is to issue paper money. Yet because the monarchs came to rely on their bankers to fund large ventures like wars and other things, ultimately the bankers gained great influence over national policies. Soon it became doubtful who was really in charge of the country. And I don't care much what the Old Testament says, but this makes a point. The Old Testament says that the borrower is servant to the lender. Thus it came that the kings often had become servants. Bankers were the masters who created and allocated purchasing power. So in this case, if this is all the way it happened in a big general sense, the European white men were not so smart after all as we like to make out. We're the smartest people of all. Well, we maybe were the most creative, but we're not the smartest, because both the Chinese, the Asians, and the Jews seemed to be smarter than the Europeans in this respect. And we know that the IQ people tell us that they have higher IQs than Europeans.
Well,
a little bit, you know, makes a difference. So these people figured this out, but our stupid Europeans were going along borrowing and giving the bankers all this power. And we know who the bankers were, what race they were, what.
Well, IQ is only a particular portion of intelligence. There's some people that have high IQs that are in some other ways blithering idiots just because they're good at math and.
Well, I agree with you. That's why I said I think we're more creative. But,
and also, you're comparing the Jews who are sort of a wandering head looking for a body, with an entire body.
Well, but even so, they managed to put this over on these all these European heads of state. And the English too, I guess.
The kings are not always the smartest people in the country.
No, wouldn't they have some advisors? What was the same now? The same now. Our leaders are not the smartest people. Geez, look who we've got for president in the United States. I mean, that's really something. We let these things be done to us. But anyway, this is the history. So that was how usury got started, how the bankers got all that power and got control over so many governments. Not outward control, but, behind the scenes control. And so then in the 1700s was the rise of Freemasonry. Adam Weishaupt and his Illuminati came along and got stronger after 1750 or so. Then the French Revolution was 1789 to 1799, that 10-year period right up to the break of 1800. And both of these, Freemasonry and the French Revolution, which was really the Freemasons were behind it, wanted to destroy religion and instituted the rights of man. What is that in French? I'm going to have...
Les droits de l'homme.
De l'homme, right. Well, I'm going to have Vincent Renoir on Friday, on Saturday's show. And he's got a new video out about homosexual marriage. And we're going to talk about that. And he mentions in that a lot... Les droits, the rights of man. He says this whole thing started with the rights of man. So, he's Catholic and you would have some, we have these differences of approach, because I know you find a lot that's good in the Freemasonic idea.
No, not really.
All right, explain.
When did I say that?
I don't know.
I see certain expressions of Freemasonic thinking in the international Jew, this idea of trying to make reason prevail. You know, every doctrine has to have some things good in it to attract people. It doesn't mean that I think it's preferable to other doctrines necessarily. I'm just trying to understand the person that I'm reading on his own terms, try to understand where he's coming from and what motivates him. That's all.
The thing with Freemasonry is that it does sound good. You know, I mean, what's wrong with the rights of man? That doesn't, why would you argue about that? I mean, it all sounds, it has all this reasonable sound, but we know that, it didn't have a good intention. And so intention was to, as I said, destroy religion and break all social ties and destroy order. Which is what actually took place. The whole world was turned upside down and it never was the same again. Whether people think that's good but it always brings in its wake a lot of stuff that gets, instigated in there. A lot of bad stuff that gets itself, into the inside that wasn't on the inside before. So, that's one of the things that's not good about it. But Peter Myers writes, the protocols predicts that after a world war, there will be an attempt to form a world government, secretly orchestrated by Jewish financiers, and this happened at the Treaty of Versailles. He says, and the protocols also predicted a despotic government in the guise of socialism, once again secretly Jewish, and this happened when Lenin and Trotsky set up the USSR. You find fault with that?
My mind was wandering.
Well, you're not paying attention. So, anyway, it is this kind of coincidence that keeps the protocols relevant, he says, because they predicted that after a world war, that there would be a world war, and afterwards there would be an attempt to form a world government, and that's exactly what happened. And also predicted a despotic government in the guise of socialism and secretly Jewish. And this happened with Lenin and Trotsky setting up what they did in the USSR. So there's that. Now,
Yeah, right? Well, what the protocols say is that liberalism will give way to autocracy, which is just a classic pattern in
history.
Well,
there you come with your autocracy again. You
well,
always,
yes, that's what it says.
You know, I say that you overuse this thing about the autocrat and autocracy because as though that's the only thing in the protocols as denouncing them because you say that's wrong. And then the other thing you do is to make too much out of the in the beginning you made too much out of the Maurice Joly material, but or maybe you still do, but now you're not you're admitting that that's only a part of it, and it could.
I've always said that it's only part of it, but it doesn't need to be the whole book in order to demonstrate that it's not what it purports to be.
Yeah.
If only one paragraph in the protocols clearly comes from Maurice Joly, then it's not the minutes of a meeting of Jews in 1896.
Okay, we give you that it's not the minutes. It didn't start as the minutes of these meetings in 1896.
Which means it's not what it claims to be, which means it's not authentic.
It doesn't mean that the ideas in there and that what's in the protocols is not a part of stuff that has been written and put forth and what moved, passed on from generation to generation for quite a long time. It doesn't mean that. It can be that. So, he says, okay, I'll just finish this. He says the protocols do represent the program of world revolution. Okay. And if this has been material that has been developing and has been around for a long time, then why wouldn't Maurice Joly have it in his and the protocols, which is dated later, have it and other things that are dated way earlier and same ideas in Freemasonry and so on in the 1700s. Oh, it's in all those places. And that doesn't mean that you say, well, that's no good. What's good about the protocols is that it presents it in a very strong and orderly fashion. And it's what I'm trying to argue is that we should not dismiss it, which is what the Jews want us to do, and say, oh, it has nothing to do with Jews, but we should study it and we should take it seriously.
We
should learn from it. Well, I know. You know, that's really where we come down to the difference. Now, okay, let me just say right here, if we didn't study the protocols, if we said, oh, this is no good, what would take its place? What is as good as that to teach us?
Mein Kampf is pretty good.
No, Mein Kampf doesn't do what the protocols do. It's very
different. You've got
you're not
going to
get people to read Mein Kampf. I mean, Mein Kampf has got a big obstacles for people to overcome who aren't about to.
You think the protocols don't have any obstacles?
Not
it's like, well known
not
as a fraud.
Like Adolf Hitler. No, but not like Adolf Hitler. No, it's different. It's so different. You know, you have to really hunt and search and everything. You have to read a whole bunch of stuff in Mein Kampf. Where in the protocols, it's all laid out in just
yeah, but some of the information is misleading, like this anti-Darwinism that's expressed in the protocols.
Okay, but I'm asking you, what would be the alternative? Where would we learn this stuff if we weren't going to read the protocols?
There are tons of books about Jews, some of them written by Jews.
I know, but somehow none of these have gotten the reputation of the protocols for laying it out in a clear fashion. People.
Regarding Eugène Sue, I couldn't verify that he was a Jew, but he was a socialist and his works were anti-Catholic. And he also has big, thick, dark eyebrows, so he really has a Jewy air about him, so my suspicion at least is
doesn't matter. Is there,
well, you told me look
wrong?
It up, so I looked it up.
No, but is there
something
wrong?
I can't verify that
true?
He was a Jew, but
if
it's,
we say
it's,
we it's, say it's, the it's, protocols were written by Jews, you know, and they say, oh no, they weren't. So if all this other stuff is written by Jews too, it's only all for the good. you know, it's not for the bad. I mean, if the
but
Jews
the protocols
have been
are not what they purport to be, and we don't know who wrote it.
Well, you
and
say
it also has stuff about the Jews that's, that we know is not accurate. It is not the case that Jews prefer or want an autocratic government.
Well, you keep saying that, but I'll bet there are people who could give you an argument on that. I'm not prepared to
See,
do
this
that.
This is a fundamental mistake that gets people pointed completely in the wrong direction. We gotta protect our constitutional republic. Well, you know what? That's the Jews have done very well under this constitutional republic because it's a system where they can use their collective influence to get things going in their direction. Under the Soviet system, Jews didn't have as much power as they have in the United States.
You know, I think that you don't argue this based on just what the facts are about, say, the protocols or any of these other things. You argue this based on other issues that you want to put emphasis on, or that you believe in or don't believe in, that you want to present well or not well. You know, and I just want to talk about simply from the standpoint of how valuable are these protocols.
You want to say they're authentic but not authentic. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I want to say they don't have to be authentic. They don't have to be the minutes of the meeting of the first Zionist Congress to be an authentic or a genuine plan of Jewish power that goes back some ways. And that's, I'm saying, really, I'm accepting what the international Jew writers are pretty much thinking, what they're saying, although even they don't say that they know that that's so, but that's the side they come down on, and I think it makes a lot of sense. Okay, so they're either it says the protocols were either the work of some such society. No, okay, I'll start over. The protocols do represent the program of world revolution, and that in view of their prophetic nature and of their extraordinary resemblance to the protocols of certain secret societies in the past, this has to be the Freemasonic societies, and maybe some Jewish things, organizations, other than that, I don't know. They were either the work of some such society, or of someone profoundly versed in the lore of secret societies, who was able to reproduce their ideas and phraseology. So, I don't know, this work of someone who understood all this or studied these secret societies and put it into their own words. So, this leaves it open for a whole lot of possibilities. It doesn't, you know, they don't want to pin it down as to where it might have come from. But it does come from these ideas of these secret societies that we think of as Freemasonic societies. Basically, that's it. And we know the Freemasonic idea is also to for this system of theirs to take over everywhere, to run the whole, to have world government and so on. And he says it will be noticed that Joly, in his preface, never claimed to have originated the scheme described in his book. On the contrary, he distinctly states that it personifies, in particular, a political system which has not varied for a single day in its application since the disastrous and, alas, too far off date of its enthronement. Well, I realize that you can look at that differently. You can say that he is meaning that he is dealing with Napoleon III, and it hasn't changed from when Napoleon I was in. Would that be correct?
I don't know
about Napoleon III, Napoleon I. But I assume Napoleon III was carrying out the same policies as Napoleon I, huh?
I don't know. Napoleon III did things like expand religious freedom, which is something that the protocols give a sinister motive, which reflects the Catholic perspective of whoever wrote that particular part of it. And he also allowed Algerians to come live in France.
Well, but
so he was kind of a leftist dictator.
Napoleon also gave a lot of emancipation to the Jews.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was the same thing, only different different, a little bit different at different times, but it was this over-immense, you know, opening up France to other racial races and ideas and so on. So,
but he says,
and he says that Joly said this in his preface that, whatever the scheme he's described in his book personifies a particular political system, which has not varied or, you know, since it began. And of course they're kind of putting, I think this is from Peter Myers. He's kind of implying this. This means when the Jews first started their plan way back in the beginning, like in the, when they were in Babylon, maybe, you know, that kind of thing, but it could also, whatever that means. But I have one more area here to go through, and that is the Jewish overreaction to the protocols. Because I'll just read this because it's faster than trying to describe it. Whether in this case the authors of the protocols were Jews, or whether the Jewish portions have been interpolated by the people into whose hands they fell is another question. Here we must admit the absence of any direct evidence. An international circle of world revolutionaries working on the lines of the Illuminati. And there was an Illuminati. I don't like talk about the Illuminati now too much, but Adam Weisskopf.
Well, there was at one time.
He called his thing the Illuminati, and it's just people who are illumined. You know, they thought they had these.
No,
new ideas,
it's there's
right?
more to it than that. There were some organizations that these were basically. What I gather from Nesta Webster is that there were groups in the 1700s called Illuminati that were basically. Jewish Kabbalistic cults that proselytized to non-Jews, basically.
Okay. Well, anyway, the Illuminati, of which the existence has already been indicated. Yeah, we've also already talked about the Illuminati with Weisskopf. And his those were the first Freemasonic societies that are associated with Illuminati. And they were Jewish. The Illuminati was Jewish. Offers a perfectly possible alternative to the learned elders of Zion. That is, this learned, instead of learned elders, it could have been an international circle of world revolutionaries working along the lines of the Illuminati and so on. He says, it would be easier, however, to absolve the Jews from all suspicion of complicity if they and their friends had adopted a more straightforward course from the time the protocols appeared. He says, some years ago, a work of the same kind was directed against the Jesuits, containing, I don't know what the name of it was, but it contained what purported to be a secret plan of revolution closely resembling the protocols. And the Jesuits indulged in no invectives, made no appeal that the book should be burnt, resorted to no fantastic explanations, but quietly pronounced the charge to be a fabrication, and the matter ended. But from the moment the protocols were published, the Jews and their friends had recourse to every torturous method of defense, brought pressure to bear on the publishers, succeeded in temporarily stopping the sales, appealed to the Home Secretary to order their suppression, concocted one clinching refutation after another, all mutually exclusive of each other, so that by the time the solution now pronounced to be the correct one appeared, we had already been assured half a dozen times that the protocols had been completely and finally refuted. But when at last a really plausible explanation had been discovered, why was it not presented in a convincing manner? Oh, that's the Joly one. All that was necessary was to state that the origin of the protocols had been found in the work of Maurice Joly.
Well, that would be an overstatement.
Well,
only parts of it come from Joly, but that's enough.
But he's saying that what they did all this, well, wait till I finish, had found in the work of Maurice Joly, giving parallels in support of this assertion. What need to envelop a good case in a web of obvious romance? Why all this parade of confidential sources of information, the pretense that Joly's book was so rare as to be almost unfindable when a search in the libraries would have proved the contrary? Why these allusions to Constantinople as a place to find the key to dark secrets, to the mysterious Mr. X, who does not wish his real name to be known, and to the anonymous ex-officer of the Okhrana, which is that Russian secret police, from whom, by mere chance, he bought the very copy of the dialogues used for the fabrication of the protocols by the Okhrana itself, although this fact was unknown. So he's saying that, that the Jews have make themselves very suspicious by their overreaction to
It's a big accusation against the Jews. The fact that they didn't like it and wanted to suppress it doesn't really prove anything.
Hey, wait a minute. That, you know, they had had these accusations against them before. As I pointed out, all these other books and all these things, a lot of this stuff had all this stuff had been cut. In fact, the anti-Semitism was rising from 1800 or so on, or before that. And all this was going on. But it was this book, The Protocols, when it came out, well, at first, I guess they didn't react so much because people didn't know about it. And they didn't start reacting until 1919 or 20 or so, when it became known.
Well, because of the Bolshevik Revolution, it had a semblance of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it convinced people that this was convincing for a lot of people that it was authentic. And because of that, people would take it seriously. And I suppose
exactly.
at that point, the Jews would like not to have people read this. But that doesn't mean that it's either authentic or not. It just means that they find it threatening.
If they find it threatening, it means that we should really know about it, shouldn't we? You know,
not necessarily.
I think so.
If somebody goes around accusing me of being a murderer or something, I'm not going to be happy about it, even if it isn't true.
Yeah, but if it's really not true and you know it's not true and you're not guilty of anything, you're not going to pay any attention to it. I wouldn't.
It depends on whether
people are going to worry about it is if you know.
Then it's a serious problem.
Come on. But you know. Now, okay, the last thing I'll say here is the conception of the Jews as the chosen people who must eventually rule the world forms indeed the basis of rabbinical Judaism. And this is true. And what is rabbinical Judaism?
That's from the 4th
Babylon.
Century AD. It's modern Judaism.
Well, and their idea is that they are the chosen people of their God, who is the God of the entire world now. He didn't used to be, but he became that. And therefore, because they have been chosen, they have the gifts, they have what God wants them to. And they put it in terms like to seek universal justice, or to enforce universal justice on all the nations, you know, to see that everything is done right, because they're the ones who know. And they will be the ones who will say what can be and what can't be. And they believe this. And this is, and this goes to the entire world. So, you know, they're going to rule the world. It's not strange. It's not crazy. And look what they've done with finance and with media and everything they've taken over that they know is what is crucial for them doing this. So, I mean, it's all so very believable. And the way it's put forth in the protocols is makes it kind of over the top in a way, but it's it makes an impression on people more than anything else people can read, and so that's why they are so intent on whatever they don't like, they call it a forgery, they call it a lie, whatever they call it, you know, a hoax and so on. And so I think that for that reason, no matter, you know, the deal with the First Congress and the minutes and so on, that it's something that we should take seriously, and in no way should we say, we don't need this. We can have better sources than this. I don't think we do. So that's where I'm glad that I have been able to come to this position because through doing this program because I hadn't, I didn't know what to think about it before this. Okay, go ahead, Henning.
Well, the Jews always love to say that so and so is a raging anti-Semite that takes the protocols seriously. So I mean,
here's what they say.
You
it's
put
the same
that
as
red
if somebody
on
calls
yourself.
You a murderer. If you know, it's the same as if you just said, if somebody calls me a murderer, oh, I might not like it. What are you going to do?
Well,
you know,
if they say
I mean,
that you take the protocol seriously, what they're saying is you're not dealing with reality.
Oh, I don't care. You know,
if you're a raging anti-Semite that reads exposés written by Jews, then that doesn't quite have the same effect, because then you're dealing with real information.
Okay, now my mind wandered because I'm trying to find my place in the next chapter.
Like Israel Shahak. He's a raging anti-Semite who read Israel Shahak or Israel Shamir. Doesn't quite carry the same, it's not quite the same smear as a raging anti-Semite who reads the protocols and believes them.
Well, you know,
because the protocols are discredited. It's a fraud. It's been exposed as a fraud.
Oh, Robert Faurisson, yeah, there you go. Well, as long as people like you keep insisting that,
because
then
I
you're
want
doing their work.
Not
you're, no,
themselves.
You're doing their work. Oh, bull. If I want, you know, I'm going to say that I don't feel like I'm discrediting myself. No, I don't feel like I'm discrediting myself. Okay, well, I think we've got that clear. You know, where we stand. I totally disagree. with that idea that we're making ourselves look like fools by talking about the protocols or reading the protocols or quoting the protocols. I reject that. And you reject the protocols, so there we go. Oh, that's clear. All right. Well, do you want to go on to the chapter? We've got, boy, we really
okay.
took a long time
chapter
with that.
15. Is the Jewish Kahal the modern Soviet? The Soviet is not a Russian but a Jewish institution. Nor is it the invention of Russian Jews of the present time, a new political device which has been set up as a vehicle of the ideas of Lenin and Trotsky. It is of ancient Jewish origin, a device which the Jews themselves invented to maintain their distinctive racial and national life after the conquest of Palestine by the Romans. By the way, the word Soviet, it just means council. That
well, that's what a kahal is. A kahal is I closed that off where I had that. But a kahal is the committee of individuals that runs the kahila, which is it's the community. These are the leaders of a Jewish self-governing Jewish community. And the Soviet was a self-governing Soviet community or communist community, communist revolutionaries.
Well, it means council.
I don't care what the word
the workers'
means.
Soviet is just a workers' council. It doesn't have to be run by Jews.
No. Well, in the beginning they were.
Right. Modern Bolshevism, which is, I'm just demystifying the word here a little bit. I think that this is quite a leap to say Soviet equals Kahal. Modern Bolshevism, which is now known to be merely the outer cloak of a long-planned coup to establish the domination of a race, immediately set up the Soviet form of government because the Jews of all countries who contributed to Russian Bolshevism had long been schooled in the nature and structure of the Soviet.
Okay.
I agree with that. The
All
Jews
right,
are
good.
Organized, and they're used to being organized. The Soviet appears in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion under the ancient name of Kahal. In the 17th protocol, this passage occurs.
Even now, our brothers are under obligation to denounce apostates of their own family or any person known to be opposed to the Kahal. When our kingdom comes, it will be necessary for all subjects to serve the state in a similar manner.
Anyone who is acquainted with contemporary Jewish life knows what this denunciation of apostates means. The bitterness of the persecution which falls upon a convert to Christianity or upon the Jewish son or daughter of an Orthodox family who chooses to marry a Gentile is without parallel among men. Very recently, in a Western state, a fine Jewish girl chose to marry a Gentile who was a newspaper man. From the time of her announcement of intention, the girl was treated as an apostate. She had died a most wretched death. Had she descended to a status of most ignominious shame, the feelings which her fate would have aroused could not have been more terrible. A darkly solemn funeral service was held for her, and on her bridal day she was declared to be dead to her people. The case is very far from being unusual. Perhaps one of the most moving descriptions of it is to be found in the life of Spinoza, the great philosopher whom modern Jews are fond of holding up for exhibition as a great ornament of their people. Spinoza's studies led him to question many of the dogmas the rabbis taught, those commandments of men, of which the New Testament speaks, and as Spinoza was already a person of influence, the very common Jewish tactic of bribery was tried upon him.
Common practice.
Yeah. There would be some hesitation in using the words just set down, the very common Jewish tactic of bribery, if they were not known to be true. There is no desire to cast aspersions which grow out of malice, but Jewish history as written by Jews provides mountains of proof that bribery was, while present knowledge amplifies that it still is, the favorite and most dependable weapon of the Jews. A Jewish writer, Jacob Israel Dehaan, a Dutch lawyer resident in Jerusalem, has recently stated that one hope of a settlement of the Arab agitation in Palestine is the ease with which the Arab press can be bribed. His words are, "There is a strong agitation here among the Arabs against what they call the Zionist peril, but the Arabs, especially the Arabian papers, are open to bribe. This weakness will cause them in the long run to lose out against us." And, of course, in the USA, this is done through advertising. They buy advertising.
Yeah.
And that keeps...
the papers on, yeah.
Keeps the radio personalities and newspapers and whatever.
But they don't even have to do that anymore. They used to do that, but now they're all staffed with Jews and their lackeys and so on.
Well, you know, I remember hearing Rush Limbaugh. At some point, you know, I just wonder why does this guy take some of the positions he does? Like on free trade, for example, he's got to know that it hurts a lot of people. I found out he had a personal financial interest in free trade. He mentioned it in one of his shows. You know, so in a way, that's bribery. Somebody got him involved in that to make sure he'd be on the right side of that issue.
He's an extreme slimeball. Extreme.
So, young Spinoza was offered an annual stipend of 1,000 florins if he would be silent upon his convictions and from time to time show himself at the synagogue. This he refused with high-minded scorn. He made ready to earn his bread by polishing lenses for optical instruments. Upon this he was excommunicated, a proceeding which is thus described. The day of excommunication at length arrived, and a vast concourse assembled to witness the awful ceremony. It began by the silent and solemn lighting of a quantity of black wax candles, and by opening the tabernacle wherein were deposited the books of the law of Moses. Thus were the imaginations of the faithful prepared for all the horror of the scene. The chief rabbi, the ancient friend and master, now the fiercest enemy of the condemned, was to order the execution. He stood there pained, but implacable. The people fixed their eager eyes upon him. High above, the chanter rose and chanted forth in loud, lugubrious tones the words of execration, while from the opposite side another mingled with these curses the thrilling sounds of the trumpet. And now the black candles were reversed and were made to melt drop by drop into a huge tub filled with blood. And that is from Liu's Biographical History of Philosophy. Then came the final anathema. With the judgment of the angels and of the saints, we excommunicate, cut off, curse, and anathematize Baruch de Espinoza. With the consent... Oh, let me say this right. With the judgments of the angels and of the saints, we excommunicate, cut off, curse, and anathematize Baruch de Espinoza. With the consent of the elders and all this holy congregation, in the presence of the holy books, by the 613 precepts which are written therein, with the anathema wherewith Joshua cursed Jericho, with the curse which Elisha laid upon the children, and with all the curses which are written in the law. Cursed be he by day, and cursed be he by night. Cursed be he in sleeping, and cursed be he in waking. Cursed in going out, and cursed in coming in. The Lord shall not pardon him. The wrath and the fury of the Lord shall henceforth be kindled against this man, and shall lay upon him all the curses written in the book of the law. The Lord shall destroy his name from the sun, and cut him off for his undoing from all the tribes of Israel, with all the curses of the firmament which are written in the law. And we warn you that none may speak with him by word of mouth, nor by writing, nor show any favor unto him, nor be under one roof with him, nor come within four cubits of him, nor read any paper composed by him. And that's from Pollock's Life of Spinoza. By the way, that word cut off, that's used a couple of times in that passage there, that's what becomes in German ausrotten.
Ausrotten. Ausrotten. That they use for what happened to the extermination of the Jews, right?
Yeah, it means they were expelled, is what it means.
Exactly right. Now, I was going to count up the number of times curse was used here in one form or another, but I forgot to do it. But man, you know, that would kind of haunt you after they did all that to you and had all these people, well, finish up here, you know, were cursing you like this.
As the blasting words were uttered, the lights were all suddenly immersed in the blood. A cry of religious horror and execration burst from all. And in that solemn darkness, and to those solemn curses, they shouted, Amen! Amen! That's from Professor J.K. Hosmer, The Jews. That is a commentary on the decree of denunciation. It also shows a very strong light on the pressure which is brought against many Jews who would cry out against the antisocial ideas of their people, but who dare not because of the penalties it would bring. This denunciation, as Protocol 17 orders, is to be made against anyone who is known to be opposed to the Kahal, or ancient Soviet system of the Jews. After the destruction of the Jewish state by the Romans, the Jews maintained a center in the Patriarch, and after dispersion of the Jews out of Palestine, this center of nationality was preserved in the Prince of Exile, or Exilarch, an office which is believed to persist to the present time, it doesn't say by whom it's believed, and which some believe to be held now by an American Jew.
Yeah, I'd like to know more of that. Too bad they don't have any sources for that.
Well, Wikipedia has an entry on Exilarch. I don't think there's any information, reliable information about any Exilarch past the 1500s. The last Exilarch was in Persia.
Well, we're almost out of time here, and I was going to ask you about that because you talk a lot about you don't believe in the autocrat, and another one that they talk about in the International Jew, and I guess in the protocols, I'm not sure if it's in the protocols, but is the Exilarch, which is the guy who's in charge of all the Jews in exile. And I wouldn't be surprised if they did have one, that he'd be an American.
Yeah, see,
right now.
I don't know how much trust this, but Wikipedia says that Exilarch was largely an honorary office.
Well, they say that stuff. Why wouldn't they? Oh. Who runs Wikipedia? The Jews, I mean, they're trying to play down all this stuff so that it's all harmless.
Well, you got to provide some evidence to the contrary.
Well, it's kind of hard. It's true.
I don't see the Jews all being run by one person. They seem to have various organizations with slightly different takes on what they ought to be doing.
Okay. Well, thank you, Hattie, for your good nature. And we'll see you next week, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.